our search efforts for him are ongoing in the area to include the waters of the inlet. And if you see him, do not attempt to contact him on your own. Please just notify law enforcement.
A distraught man with a gun forces the overnight closure of the Seward Highway. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, essential air service is not just important for Alaska.
I think we're second only to the state of Alaska in terms of the impact on it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
The Seward Highway headed south out of Anchorage was closed for 12 hours last night and into this morning because of what Anchorage police described as a distraught man. A manhunt is still underway for a suspect who allegedly discharged a weapon multiple times. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, the incident, combined with avalanches in the area, trapped area residents and knocked out power.
Alaska State Troopers say they were notified shots had been fired at the highway pull-off by Beluga Point shortly after 8 p.m. Wednesday. Megan Peters is a spokesperson for the Department of Public Safety and says police from Anchorage and troopers from Seward tried to contact the suspect immediately.
The subject did fire off a handgun. APD SWAT personnel later responded to the scene, as well as members of the Alaska State Trooper Special Emergency Reaction Team. And then the highway was shut down due to the public safety concerns associated with the incident.
Troopers say the suspect is 36-year-old Kevin Thibodeau, identified online as a former Army captain who's worked as a communications manager for the Native Corporation representing shareholders in Utqiagvik. Though the highway was reopened at about 9:30 Thursday morning, Thibodeau has not yet been located. The investigation is being led by the state's Department of Public Safety. Peters says a handgun and other evidence were discovered in the area, a rugged terrain pressed between the rocky shores of Cook Inlet to one side and steep cliffs just across the roadway.
Our search efforts for him are ongoing in the area to include the waters of the inlet. If anyone has any information regarding his whereabouts, they're advised to call 911. And if you see him, do not attempt to contact him on your own. Please just notify law enforcement.
The road closure stranded people trying to travel between Anchorage and the communities along Turnagain Arm down to Girdwood and the Kenai Peninsula. On top of that, there was an unplanned avalanche in the area that knocked out equipment along the same highway, shutting down power to many of the same residents. Grace Green works by the port in Anchorage, but lives in Girdwood. She and her family went to bed Wednesday without power.
You know, alarm goes off around 5:30 in the morning. I noticed that I had received a text message with the 10% battery life I had left that the school buses were not able to make it down to Girdwood, but the Girdwood school was still open and would operate as normal. So power was still out for us at that point, but we were starting to kind of get up and go through our normal morning routine.
According to the Chugach Electric Company, power was restored to the area before 8 a.m. Green spent the day working from home with her young son, who goes to preschool in Anchorage, says the experience is a good reminder about life in an area with only one road going in each direction.
In Alaska, we rely daily on critical infrastructure, and when something comes up and the road gets closed, not only can people not get to or from their homes, but it stops the flow of the supply chain.
According to troopers, the ongoing search for Thibodeau is dependent on weather. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
In an annual report released today, BP's Alaska subsidiary reported a profit of $85 million in 2016. That's compared to a $172 million loss in Alaska in 2015. BP also reported a global profit this year. That's after a global loss of $6.5 billion for 2015, its worst ever. Despite the profit, the British company also announced a significant cut to CEO Bob Dudley's pay. Multiple national news outlets report this is because BP's shareholders were unhappy that Dudley was set to receive a raise despite the record loss in 2015. Due to plunging oil prices, BP cut about 260 jobs in Alaska last year, about 13% of its workforce. But according to a BP spokesperson, the company is not planning any broad-scale layoffs this year. The company currently employs about 1,700 workers in Alaska. Alaska is a big beneficiary of the Essential Air Service Program, but Alaska's congressional delegation isn't the only one urging that the subsidy continue. Democratic Senator Gary Peters of Michigan said at a hearing today he was floored to learn President Trump is proposing to eliminate funding for the program, which he says is vital for rural communities.
This is quite a slap in the face to something that's absolutely critical for their continued economic development.
Essential Air Service pays airlines to defray the cost of serving eligible rural airports. For Alaska, it pays carriers nearly $21 million to serve 61 airports. At the high end, Alaska Airlines gets $2 million a year to serve Cordova. Ward Air receives less than $6,000 for flights to Chatham. Senator Peters says the name Essential Air Service says it all.
And in the state of Michigan, I actually have 9 airports that would be impacted as a result of these cuts. I think we're second only to the state of Alaska in terms of the impact on it.
Actually, Michigan's eligible airports receive heavier subsidies, so their total benefit from EAS was slightly higher than Alaska's this year. Senator Dan Sullivan of Alaska didn't attend the hearing, but was among 20 senators who signed a letter asking for continued funding for the program. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, wildlife troopers search for poachers near Bethel.
One muskox was dead, and then another one appeared to be shot in the eye and other parts of its body.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The 2017 Kobuk 440 Sled Dog Race begins today in Kotzebue. 16 teams will head out in a mass start in front of the Nulagvik Hotel at 12:30 today. The trail stretches from Kotzebue through Norvik, Kayana, Ambler, and Shungnak out to Kobuk and back. Mushers drew for their bib numbers at a she-fish potluck in Kotzebue last night, with a high school band playing the national anthem. Kobuk 440 board president and race coordinator Carmen Daggett.
Of course, bib numbers don't have significance in the sense that it's not when they're going to actually be able to leave if we do a mass start. So it's just to kind of help us keep track of which mushers are where and so that the public can identify people.
2016 Kobuk 440 champion Nicholas Petit returns again this year, not long after claiming third place in this year's Iditarod sled dog race. Western Alaska mushers Richie Deal of Aniak and Catherine Keith of Kotzebue will join names like Hugh Neff, Jim Lanier, and Jason Mackey. And Jeff King will be racing against his daughter, Ellen King, this year. Second place Iditarod finisher Dallas Seavey will be making his Kobuk 440 debut alongside this year's sixth place Iditarod finisher Wade Mars. And Kevin Hansen of Kotzebue will be competing in his first ever distance sled dog race. Hansen's father, Paul, finished his rookie year of the Iditarod this year. Four mushers withdrew before the race start due to various concerns for personal health or sick dogs. Those four include Tony Brown, Sim Smith, Emily Maxwell, and Chuck Schaefer. The total number of mushers allowed to compete in the Kobuk 440 is capped at 20. Daggett says the first teams are expected to cross the finish line in Kotzebue sometime late Sunday night or early Monday morning. The finishers' banquet will be held Monday at 6 p.m. The purse total this year is $60,000. Two muskox have been poached near Bethel, and Alaska wildlife troopers are searching for whoever's responsible. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports the troopers found the two animals near the snow machine trail between the Bethel dump and Akyachak on Sunday.
The scene described by troopers was one no hunter could condone.
One muskox was dead, and then another one appeared to be shot in the eye and other parts of its body. It was limping badly, and it couldn't see because of the bullet wound to the eye, so it was kind of staggering around, kind of out of it.
Brent Gibbons is an Alaska wildlife trooper out of McGrath handling the case.
So the decision was made to put that second animal down since it was fatally wounded.
Both muskox had been shot multiple times with small caliber rifles.
Not large caliber rifles like you would normally use if you were actually going to target muskox, if you were going muskox hunting.
No meat had been salvaged from either muskox. Several four-wheelers and one snow machine were seen leaving the area by the person who discovered the animals. Troopers are seeking information regarding who's responsible for the poaching. Gibbon says the Alaska Wildlife Safeguard Program is offering a cash reward for information that leads to prosecuting the offenders.
I know how it is in small communities, and people are sometimes hesitant to step forward with information, but they can do that anonymously through that program.
Offenders could be charged with taking muskox in a closed area and failure to salvage edible meat. Poaching animals that are part of a small population affects the whole herd. Gibbon says illegal killings like these undercut the ability for the muskox herd to grow into a population the area could one day hunt.
Basically, these satellite herds of muskox that move in from the coast come establish new territories. And the exciting thing about that is, if they're not poached, they could actually set up new herds and new territorial ranges, and those herds could grow possibly to legally huntable populations.
Troopers have salvaged the meat from the two muskox and have donated it to charities in Bethel. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Lower North Slope oil prices are taking a bite out of Native Corporation dividends. Sea Alaska, Southeast's regional corporation, just announced it will pay out $10.6 million to its 22,000 members mid-month. That's a third less than last year's spring distribution. Sea Alaska President and CEO Anthony Malott says it's dropped because of lower payouts from a pool of natural resource earnings from all regional Native corporations.
Arctic Slope Regional Corporation is seeing declining oil royalties from the fields that are on their lands. And that offers direct 7i to Sea Alaska and all of the other regionals.
7i is a provision of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act describing how corporations are to share resource revenues. The Settlement Act created the corporations. This month's Sea Alaska payments will range from $133 to $609 per 100 shares, depending on membership in other Native corporations and other factors. Resource revenue pool payments are the difference between the two accounts. Malott says the second largest dividend revenue source is one of Sea Alaska's investment accounts.
The permanent fund distribution is very stable. It offers close to $4 million annually in distributions.
The other source is the corporation's own business earnings, which have been down. They dropped significantly in 2013 after its construction subsidiary lost more than $25 million. Two Alaskans traveled to Austria last month to compete in the Special Olympics World Winter Games. And as Alaska Public Media's Josh Edge reports, both came back with some hardware.
Jennifer Troutman is an alpine skier, and at this year's World Games, she competed in two events, medaling in the Super G.
Second place and winner of the silver medal for Special Olympics United States of America, Jennifer Troutman!
The 23-year-old from Anchorage also received a participation ribbon in the giant slalom. Troutman has been competing in alpine skiing for the last 7 years, but she says this was her first time competing on an international stage.
It was amazing. I mean, I get to the gate and I just zone in on those first six gates, I think it was. It was awesome.
Leading up to the World Games, Troutman did most of her training runs at Anchorage's Hilltop ski area. So when it came to competing on a different and bigger mountain in Austria, she says it was a bit of a change.
Schladming was some of the roughest terrain because it was spring skiing.
She says the snow on the race course was crystallized, which made for some really fast but challenging runs. Sarah Arts is the director of sports and programs for Special Olympics Alaska. She says it's a complex and in-depth process for an athlete to qualify for and compete in the World Games. Because they compete for Special Olympics USA with teammates from around the country, only a couple Alaskan athletes get to go. Among the many steps is ensuring the athlete has the ability and time to train. For example, she says Jennifer Troutman's training began almost a year ago.
They worked on specific skills in the gym that would help her on the ski slope. Once the snow hit the ground, she was probably on the mountain 3 to 4 times a week.
Another Alaskan athlete also competed at the World Games, snowboarder Madison Englund. Englund lives in Fairbanks, which Sarah Arts says can make things a little more complicated.
Because if it's too cold, they can't get out on the mountain. And there was a couple week stretch there where she wasn't able to get outside and actually snowboard, so she had to do creative dryland training to stay in shape.
But despite the minor training issues, Englund still managed to snag a gold medal in the snowboarding Super G. Englund also claims silver in the giant slalom. The Special Olympics World Games are held every 2 years, alternating between winter and summer sports. Alpine skier Jennifer Troutman says she had fun meeting athletes from around the world and competing at the international level.
And I would do it all over again. I'm hooked.
And that's an opportunity she might have again in a couple years. She's preparing for the state's summer games, where she'll compete in swimming. If she does well, she could have a chance to compete at the 2019 Special Olympics Summer Games in Abu Dhabi. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Yesterday, we told you about the new legislation that names October 25th as African American Soldiers' Contribution to Building the Alaska Highway Day. All 19 senators who were present and 39 of the 40 House members voted for the bill. Wasilla Republican Representative David Eastman was the only lawmaker to vote no. He says the state shouldn't single out black soldiers.
To create a new state law before there's been an opportunity to recognize all Alaskan veterans who gave their lives building the highway, I think it's premature.
Researchers found that many black soldiers helped build the highway in 1942, 6 years before the military was integrated. Palmer Republican Representative Delana Johnson says the bill recognizes that African Americans were singled out for unfair treatment.
We should recognize mistakes that we've made in the past, and to ignore them would be a mistake.
Johnson noted that many black soldiers who wanted to fight in World War II weren't allowed to do so. She added that those who built the highway contributed to Alaska's history.
The racial division was already made. The government made that racial division.
Of the bill, Eastman says, two wrongs don't make a right. He replied to a question from a reporter about his views on race by citing his service in the Army and Army Reserve.
I wore a green uniform for 12 years. And green was what we looked at, and the rest we didn't. And it worked very well.
The bill now heads to Governor Bill Walker's desk for his signature.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Canada geese have touched down at the Creamers Field Refuge in Fairbanks. Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologist Mark Ross says the first of iconic birds synonymous with spring in the interior was spotted at the refuge Tuesday, April 4th, continuing a trend toward earlier arrivals.
76 to 96, the average date of arrival for that 20 years was April 15th. From 97 to this year, the average day of arrival is April 8th, and for the last 10 years, it was April 7th, so we're creeping up to that first week of April.
Ross says 11 geese were tallied at the refuge yesterday during the first official count of the season. He says spring migration is weather-dependent.
If conditions are good for moving north in the spring, they do it as soon as possible to get to their breeding sites.
Ross says a marking study in the 1990s showed the Canada geese coming through Creamers Refuge overwintering in Washington and Oregon. What are methane hydrates, and what role could they play in global warming? That's a question a listener posed this week for the segment Ask a Climatologist. Brian Brettschneider says methane hydrates are clumps of gas encased in an ice-like substance sitting on the ocean floor. Some scientists have thought of these hydrates as a sort of a time bomb for climate change. Brettschneider told Annie Feit the idea is that warming oceans could eventually release the methane into the atmosphere.
They are a potentially large reservoir of hydrocarbons that are spread pretty evenly around the globe in the oceans.
How do methane hydrates play into the greenhouse gas equation?
That's a good question, because methane as a greenhouse gas is much more potent than carbon dioxide. Depending on the time scale, 20, even 50 times as potent as carbon dioxide. And so there's quite a bit of concern about this methane hydrates, which are like a kind of like an ice that is on the seabed floor, that as temperatures rise, the very delicate equilibrium that it's in based on temperature and water pressure, that these might be disassociated and released and work their way to the atmosphere and cause kind of a runaway greenhouse gas effect. So that's a concern that people have.
What does the science say on that? I mean, how big of a concern do you think methane hydrates are?
Well, earlier this year, the United States Geological Survey did a meta-analysis looking at a bunch of different studies over many, many years. And they kind of tightly constrained what the known quantities of methane hydrates are, which turned out to be less than what was originally thought, quite a bit less, actually. And then they walk through the scenarios about how much might be released under certain situations. And they came to the conclusion that the catastrophic potential is much less likely than maybe some people think. So as these methane hydrates might be released, they talk about terms of timeframes of centuries for some of these gases to make it to the atmosphere. But along the way, during those centuries, most of that sinking back into the seabed floor. So the net effect is it could still be bad, but probably not as bad as what we were thinking just even a few years ago.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. Bogoslav Volcano is back at a low-level advisory for the first time since it began erupting more than 3 months ago. The Alaska Volcano Observatory downgraded Bogoslav's alert level yesterday, bringing it just one notch above normal. Dave Schneider, a geophysicist with the AVO, says it's been weeks since the Aleutian volcano showed any signs of life.
With volcanoes, you're never quite sure whether or not the eruption is over for good. You can't differentiate between stages of quiet. Quiet for the next day is the same as quiet for the next, year or two. But enough time has passed where we feel that it's prudent to bring the alert level down.
After being quiet for a quarter century, Bogoslav has exploded 37 times since mid-December. Schneider says the eruption has been fascinating for his team at the AVO. They've collected ash samples from two major blasts that will help model the behavior of this unusual submarine volcano.
Well, we're all kind of jazzed about this. Bogoslav's very stimulating, right? It's like new and different. And this is a really talented group of scientists at AVO. And for a volcano that had no monitoring network on it, I think we've really learned an awful lot about it.
AVO scientists are planning to present their research later this year. In the meantime, Schneider says they're eager to see the volcano firsthand. The eruption has dramatically reshaped Bogoslav Island, but they'll have to wait a while before it's safe for a visit.
It's a pretty hazardous place, so we're very wary about going out there for the foreseeable future, maybe sometime this summer.
The AVO has lowered the alert level for Cleveland volcano as well. Cleveland has cooled down after exploding last month, so scientists have issued a low-level advisory. Ketchikan's first marijuana retail store could open as early as Saturday if the operation passes an inspection scheduled for today. KRBD's Layla Carey went by the Stony Moose on Stedman Street to see the progress last week and talk with the business owners.
Watch your step, because it's still an active construction site here, but if you come back here...
Mark Woodward leads the way down a boardwalk alley to the main entrance of what will be the Stony Moose retail marijuana store and eventually, maybe he hopes soon, cannabis cafe. The cafe would allow patrons with a focus on summertime cruise visitors to purchase marijuana and smoke it right there at the business before heading out for other experiences. The State Marijuana Control Board has declined so far to approve regulations allowing on-site consumption, but Woodward remains optimistic.
Eventually, we think that those are going to go through and will be approved hopefully by June is what we're hoping, maybe even sooner than that. And so right now...
So you're not feeling defeated by the state board's decision to not take action on that?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. In fact, I think it gives them a chance to really look at exactly what they want. I think, in fact, Eric and I have the best plans for on-site right now because we consider everything. We have plans for circulating employees, you know, so that not one employee stays in this area for so long and this, that, and the other. And we've already bought our air handling system, is ready to go. And so, but like I said, we're pushing pause on all that because we want to get our store open, our retail store. And so we'll go back this way.
We were out on the back deck with a view of Ketchikan Creek and the occasional river otter scurrying up a rocky bank. We stroll back to the alley entrance, which will be the main access for the retail store. Inside, it doesn't look like it will be ready in a week. The walls are framed but not finished, and a work crew is there busy hammering nails. But they don't have to finish the whole thing. Just the retail area and office and the bathrooms need to be ready for what they have planned as the first stage. And they're definitely starting small. The retail area is tiny, about the size of a walk-in closet.
Pretty small area.
It's going to be it for your retail.
Exactly, because what we're going to do is we have a large glass counter that'll be fit here, and we'll do something called deli style.
Deli style in this case means the various marijuana strains will be in big jars. A bud tender will help customers choose what they want, weigh it out, and package it up. They're working hard to get the space ready in time for their April 6th inspection, and it's a little tight. But Woodward says it was either that day or they'd have to wait until late April.
We've had so many people coming up to us locally saying, hey, tick-tock, when are we opening here? And so... We got everyone together last week, and we said, what do you guys think? Give me an honest answer. And literally everybody was like, hey, we want to see you guys open.
And while it does still look rough inside, Eric Reamer says the renovation is moving along really well.
You'd be surprised how quick it goes from the studs to a finished product. Once you hang some rock up, you put the drywall up and a paint job, and all of a sudden you're in a finished room rather than just a roughed-in construction zone. We'll be there. That's like a one-day thing.
So the two entrepreneurs fully expect to get their license on April 6th. And it's only after they have that signed, official, stamped license that they can receive product. Woodward says they have a plan in place with Green Leaf out of Sitka, which will provide up to 5 types of marijuana for the store initially, and some from a grower out of Fairbanks. That product should arrive on the 7th, and they're planning an April 8th opening. So, if all goes as expected, their first customer will be the first person to buy marijuana legally in Alaska's first city. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes, Josh Edge, Annie Fite, and Elizabeth Harball in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Margaret DeMarburis in Nome, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Laura Craigle in Unalaska, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.